This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And as we said, we're in the beginning of the fifth chapter of Shmuel, of Aleph, of the first book of Shmuel. So they had taken the ark and put it in the house of Dagon. Dagon was this mermaid-looking idol that they worshipped, placing it next to Dagon. Now there is a dispute among the rabbis in the Chazal as to whether they did this as an act of mastery over the ark, put it next to Dagon and let Dagon deal with the ark, or an act of honor. Where are we going to put this ark? It's a godly object, so let's put it in a godly place. The Ashdodites arose early the next day, and they came in to see. This actually was quite an interesting thing for them. They had taken their god, and they had taken the god of the Jews. And bear in mind, there is something quaint about idolatry. At least they believe in some kind of supernatural force. It's not completely secular. There is some kind of a religious dogma. And here for the first time they have brought the God of the Jews, who is the only God, don't forget, who has proved himself historically and scientifically several times, and everybody knew about that. Egypt and the splitting of the Red Sea and everything that went with it was fairly well known that he was a powerful God. And there the Aron, which is the only object we've got, because we don't have idols, we don't have images of God, but the Aron, the Ark, was to the Philistines at least the embodiment of that objectification that we talked about in the last year, I think, or the one before, the objectification of a religious principle, and they put the two gods together. So they must have rushed in the next morning to see what happened. Because if these are two forces, If the ark represents the force of God and Dagon represents the force of idolatry, and they despise each other, then something must have happened overnight. These two forces are not going to sit next to each other all night and not engage with one another. The Ashdodites arose early the next day, and behold, Dagon had fallen upon his face to the ground before the ark of Hashem. So they found Dagon had fallen over and was lying prostrate in front of the ark. So they took Dagon and returned it to its place. Now they weren't quite sure, is this a coincidence? Was there a little earth tremor and Dagon fell over? Not quite ready to attribute it to some kind of battle that took place and the ark beat Dagon in the battle. And so they carefully put Dagon back into position. They arose early the next morning. They couldn't get there fast enough. Now let's see what's happened. The second night they've been together. Let's see what happens now. And they rush into the sanctuary here to see what has occurred. And again, Dagon had fallen upon his face to the ground before the ark of Hashem. And Dagon's head and the two palms of his hands were severed, lying upon the threshold. Only Dagon's body remained intact. So not only had it fallen over, but it had become damaged in the process, and in an interesting way. Heads and hands removed, the body is intact. This is why the priests of Dagon and all those who come to the house of Dagon do not tread upon the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. There's a certain fear of that threshold. So again, they attribute it to the threshold more than to the ark of God. So God has given them these indications that the ark doesn't belong there. God has now given them indications that it's not a good idea to put the ark and Dagon next to each other, and that Dagon is the one who's going to come off second best, and that it would be in their interests now to return the ark, which is what one would have expected them to do. But that in fact isn't what occurs. They keep the ark. And we're told therefore in verse 6, Vatichpad Yad Hashem ala Ashdodim, and the hand of Hashem then became heavy against the Ashdodites, and he devastated them. He struck them, Ashdod and its surrounding areas, with hemorrhoids. I don't know if they're hemorrhoids, but there was some kind of tchorim, it's called. It was a disease, a very uncomfortable disease. The men of Ashdod were frightened because of this, and they said, "Let the ark of God of Israel not stay with us, for its hand has been hard against us and against Dagon our God." So as long as Dagon was falling over on his face every night, they didn't mind that much. When they started getting hemorrhoids, they thought it's time to send the ark back. They summoned and gathered all the governors of the Philistines to them, and they said, "What should we do about the ark of God of Israel?" They replied, "Let the ark of God of Israel be transferred to Gath." Let's get it further away. Out, the people of Gath are stronger. These viruses don't get there that far. Maybe this is just an illness around the area. Let's get the ark out of here and see what happens. So they transferred the ark of God of Israel. It was after they transferred it that the hand of Hashem was set against the city, causing a great commotion. He struck the people of the city from small to great, and he afflicted them internally with hemorrhoids again. It was an internal disease now, because the previous one was an external disease. This was an internal disease, and it started consuming their intestines. It wasn't a comfortable disease. They then set the ark of Hashem to Ekron. It happened when the ark of God arrived in Ekron that the people of Ekron cried out, saying, "They have transferred to me the ark of God of Israel to kill me and my people. Get rid of it. We don't want it. Get it out of here." So they're now encountering a civil uprising. The people of the Philistine nations don't want to host the Ark of God. The news has got around that this doesn't do the community any good. So they summoned and gathered all the governors of the Philistines and said, "Send away the Ark of the God of Israel. Let it return to its place, and let it not kill me and my people." For there was panic of death in the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The people who did not die were stricken with hemorrhoids, and the cry of the city ascended to heaven. That's the first chapter that we do tonight. Now, it's interesting. Let me just see if I can find this for you. I mentioned to you these two views as to whether this was an act of victory over the ark, putting it in the proximity of Dagon, or, as Rabbi Yochanan learns, it was an act of kibduhu. They were trying their best to honor the ark. Where could you put the ark other than with Dagon? Amri, they said, "Zeh Elohav, Zeh Elohav, this is a god, and this is a god. Yavo Elohav, Yishrei Tzal Elohav, let this god come and be with this god." Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish amar, imkach, if that's the case, why would they have been punished? If they were doing their best to honor the ark, and the only place they had was in their sanctuary, where are you going to put it? Where are they going to keep it? In a fairly honorable place, in a place where it's not going to be profaned and defiled. Surely that would be the right place to put it. If that was their good intent, why should they have been punished so horribly for doing that? Does anybody want to suggest an answer? And therefore the other view is, no, they were punished because their intention was to teach the ark a lesson, to show the ark that it's under the authority of Dagon. And that's why they were punished. But still we have the view of Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't back down from his view. He still says, no, the intention of the people was to honor the ark. And yet they were punished. Rabbi Yochanan doesn't supply us the answer. We've got to work the answer out ourselves. What is the answer? Why were they punished? What did they do wrong?
Well, they removed the ark from its place.
Well, but they're not punished, that's correct, they had captured the ark, but at least they're keeping it in a good place, and they seem to be punished by virtue of its proximity with Dagon, that there was something wrong with it.
To be back where it belongs.
So the one thing is that they should have sent it back altogether. They're being punished for keeping it, quite a heavy punishment. The other is in the words that I read, and that's why I read the specific words out, they said, "Zeh Elokav v'zeh Elokav." This is a god, and that is a god. Let them both stay in the sanctuary together. Remember those of you who were here last week for the Chanukah Shiur? Well, we said, isn't that exactly what's happening today? A Christmas tree and a menorah. This is Hanukkah, it's Christmas. There's no difference. As long as you've got your religion, we've got our religion. We all believe in God. It's all the same thing. It isn't the same thing. It's totally different. Christianity and Judaism are not the same at all. They have nothing in common. Nothing. There is no commonality. They are two opposite religions. Whatever Judaism believes in, Christianity doesn't, and whatever Christianity believes in, Judaism doesn't believe in. Except the ethical things, which everybody believes in, because they like chicken soup. The fact everybody believes that don't harm your neighbor and that kind of stuff, that every religion believes. That's not religion, that's a moral system. So sure, all religions share a similar moral system, that's no big deal. But in terms of the religion, in terms of the philosophy, in terms of the understanding, there is no commonality. They're opposite, they're different. Each has their value. There's no law. that non-Jewish people should not practice, no Torah law that non-Jewish people should not practice Christianity? Not at all. There's nothing wrong with it for a non-Jewish person to practice. But for a Jewish person, there is something wrong. It's a very different religion. And so with all the other religions. And even within Judaism itself, the tendency that there is today, that there's not that much difference after all. Orthodox, modern Orthodox, conservative, reform. At the end of the day, it's all the same kind of... It's not the same. It's very different. And it's important to appreciate differences. One cannot have any sense of pride and security in what one is if one doesn't understand how one is differentiated also from others. Chassidim and Misnagdim, at the end of the day, they're all the same. They're not the same. Chassidim and Mitnagdim are very different. They believe in different things. They are part of the same religion. They are both Jews. They are both religious Jews. They both keep the same Shulchan Aruch, but they're very different. And it's important to understand differences. What they're being punished for is putting these two gods together. This is a god and that's a god. There is a diminishment of God in an effort to equate. There is such a desire to equate. There is such a desire to find similarity, to find congruence, to find equality in things, that we're willing to compromise the essence of everything in order to find that kind of congruence, that kind of... So how often does it happen that you're having an argument with a person and he says day and you say night? And you put a good argument about night, and he says, well, that's exactly what I'm saying. And you say, you know, then I'm finished. I don't understand you. There is some desire for people to achieve congruence, to achieve consensus. We don't all have to agree. It's quite okay that there are different religions in the world. It's quite okay that there are different brands of the Jewish religion, that there are different brands of orthodoxy. It's quite okay. It's, as long as there's authenticity, as long as there's faithfulness, it doesn't matter. It's okay. One can debate. One can reason. The time when you can't reason is when there's this overarching effort to make everything the same. Then you can't. And what they're accused of and what they're punished for, according to Rabbi Yochanan, is Zeloka v'Zeloka. This is a god and this is a god. Let's put them together. They belong in the same place. They don't belong in the same place. They cannot be in the same place. They cannot be sustained in the same place. Now we move into the next chapter, into chapter 6. The Ark of Hashem, we're told in the first sentence, had been in the land of the Philistines for 7 months. The Philistines called upon the priests and the sorcerers. Now, sorcerers don't have a picture of the sorcerers as ancient magicians and things like that. The sorcerers, I suppose, if you want to try and picture what the sorcerers are, it's something like the people who claim to be involved in Kabbalah today. You know that? They're sorcerers. That's sorcery. They're mystics. And they called in the priests and the mystics because there are two essential issues that have to be decided. The one is, what shall we do about the Ark of Hashem? Should we keep it? Should we send it back? Where should we put it? What should we do with it? And the second that is, inform us how we should send it back to its place. If we are going to send it back to its place, how do we do it? Are we going to deliver it ourselves? Are we going to take it? Are we going to send it by FedEx or UPS? How are we going to actually transport the Ark of Hashem to where it needs to go? And what are we going to send with it? They replied, if you're sending back the Ark of God of Israel, you must not send it back empty-handed. So they're not committing themselves onto whether it's good to send it back or not, because that's a political question. You've now got the Ark. You've captured the crown jewel. And you're talking about sending it back. So in a sense, the priests are out of their depths. And they say, well, about sending it back or not, we'll still deal with that. But one thing is for sure, if you do send it back, you must certainly send back a guilt offering to him. Then you will be healed, and then you will realize why his hand would not turn away from against you. So, what they're saying is, we don't really know if this is God or it isn't. We don't know if this is some disease which just coincidentally happens to have come at the same time as the capturing of the Ark. Imagine if it would happen today. And we look at this and we say, but they're idiots. Couldn't they see what was happening? But imagine if it happened today. We did something I don't know what, we built some monument on the place of the Temple Mount, and a major disease took place. What would can you imagine the scientists saying, you know why? People are dying from this disease in Haifa because of what they're doing in Jerusalem. Because they're building something on the Temple Mount. They better stop building on the Temple Mount. It won't happen. We will always try and give scientific reasons for everything that occurs. Because a scientific reason doesn't really answer the question of why is it happening. It only answers the question of how. What is the mechanism used for it to happen? We've discussed this before in one of the Shiurim already. So if I get ill, God forbid, and I say to the doctor, why did I get ill? And he says, because you came into contact with so-and-so who also had that illness. And it's an infectious illness, so you got it. Quite simple. That doesn't really answer my question of why did I get it. He simply answered the question of how did I get it. The question why I got it, a doctor can't answer. He would be unscientific if he answered. He would have to say, why did you get it? You obviously did an Avera. You obviously did something wrong. Go and figure out. Do tshuva if you want to get fixed. I can't fix that. I can only provide the mechanisms with which God can fix you. But I can't tell you why. So science will not deal. It is not science's area to deal with the whys. But we in our minds have elevated science into the priests of the why. And we satisfy ourselves with the answers they give. And it's in all sciences. We discussed it before. Why did I lose all this money on the stock exchange? Well, it's because there was a correction and there was this and there was that. You know, but I know a friend of mine who didn't lose all that money on the stock exchange. Now, go and explain that. Well, that's because he took it out, and there are all sorts of reasons. We're explaining hows. We're explaining mechanisms. The why is because God willed it so. Why did God will it so? Figure it out yourself. That's the essence. Try and figure out why God did it, and that ties into some degree to what we discussed last week. And so even if it happened today, we would not be willing so quickly to recognize that this is a God-given occurrence. And the priests and the sorcerers say, we're not sure ourselves whether God is really that involved in us and that powerful and that quick in his response to be sending out these messages and these diseases simply because we've got the ark. But they have a test. They're going to actually put this all to test. And they said, in verse 4, they said, what is the guilt offering that we should send back to him? They answered, according to the number of Philistine governors, 5 golden images of hemorrhoids and 5 golden mice. Because these little things, these bugs that were eating up their intestines looked like little mice. So take the very thing to show God that you understand that the disease is being caused by him. So give him gold, because he likes money, but give him gold in the form that communicates to him that you understand the linkage between the disease and the wrongdoing, and that you're asking forgiveness for the wrongdoing. For the same plague is upon all of you and upon your governors. Make your images of hemorrhoids and your images of mice, which are demolishing the country, and give them as homage to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will alleviate his hand from upon you and your gods and your land. Why should you harden your hearts as Egypt and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? It was a well-known fact. Don't go and do the same as Egypt. Sit around just because of the glory of capturing the ark. Are you going to devastate your nation? This is the time to give in. Give back the ark to ark and live. Did it not happen that when he mocked them, they had sent the Israelites forth and they left? So now take materials and make one new wagon, and take 2 nursing cows upon whom a yoke was never placed, and tie the cows to the wagon and send their calves back home from behind them. Now what's that all about? Take 2 nursing cows who are not used to schlepping wagons. Don't take oxen. Take 2 cows that have never schlepped anything. And tie them to the wagon and take their calves and send their calves back home. In other words, to create an unlikely force to carry the ark out. The cows don't want to carry a wagon. They're not trained in carrying wagons. There we are. Still got plenty of seats for you. Are you here alone tonight?
Yes. We're probably on the way.
Well, I don't know somebody who can tell you why it happened, but I know somebody who can tell you how to fix it. And so we're taking these cows that are not desiring of carrying and drawing wagons, and they've got young calves who are calling them. So it would be unnatural for the cows to leave the calves and take the ark back to Israel. Then take the ark of Hashem and place it onto the wagon and put the golden objects that you are sending back to him as a guilt offering in a box at its side. Send it forth and it will go. Wait and see what happens. Leave it to God. We'll see what happens. Then you will see. If it ascends by the road to its boundary towards Beit Shemesh, then it was he who brought upon us all this great evil. So we're saying to God, come and fetch your ark. Take it yourself. We're relinquishing it. We don't want it or desire it anymore. The ark is on a wagon with cows. But we're not doing anything more than that. You guide the cows to Beit Shemesh if you want your ark back. But if not, we will know that his hand did not afflict us, but it was all by chance that this befell us. So the priests and sorcerers are very clever. They're saying, we don't know the answer. We're going to test God to check it out. We're going to create a scenario in which it would be unnatural for the ark to find its way back to Beit Shemesh. If despite our efforts it does find its way back to Beit Shemesh, we'll know that God's behind all this, and then hopefully your insurance money would have paid off the little gold rats and hemorrhoids that you put onto it. The men did so. They took two nursing cows and tied them to the wagon and secured their calves at home. They placed the ark of Hashem onto the wagon, along with the box and the golden mice and the images of hemorrhoids. And there's a touch of comedy in the whole thing, you must admit. The cows set out on the direct road, on the road to Beit Shemesh. On a single road did they go. They didn't wander around. They made a beeline straight for Beit Shemesh. Lowing as they went, and they did not veer right or left, the governors of the Philistines went behind them until the border of Beit Shemesh. Till the Philistine-Israel border, the governors walked behind. Now, what concerns us is the rest of the chapter, from verse 13 to the end. The people of Beit Shemesh were reaping the wheat harvest in the valley when they raised their eyes and saw the ark, and they rejoiced to see it. The wagon came to the field of Yoshua, a Beit Shemeshite, and stopped there where there was a large rock. They chopped the boards of the wagon and offered up the cows as an elevation offering to Hashem. The Levites had unloaded the ark of Hashem and the box that was with it, in which were the golden objects, and placed them upon a large rock. The people of Beit Shemesh offered up elevation offerings and slaughtered feast offerings on that day to Hashem. The five Philistine governors saw all this and returned to Ekron on that day. The ark was now in good hands. It was clear that God was behind it, and they went home. These are the golden hemorrhoids that the Philistines set as a guilt offering to Hashem, for Ashdod one, for Gaza one, for Ashkelon one, for Gat one, for Ekron one, and golden mice corresponding to the number of all Philistine cities of the five governors who ruled from the fortified city until the open village, until the great morning stone, upon which they placed the ark of Hashem, which to this day is in the field of Yeshua the Beit Shemeshite. So when this book was written, that stone was still there. All that very nice. But look what happens in verse 19. And he smote some of the men of Beit Shemesh because they peered disrespectfully into the ark of Hashem. He struck among them 70 men, 50,000 men. Now, something's wrong with the arithmetic. 70 men, 50,000 men. Was it 50,000 or was it 70? The people mourned because Hashem had smitten the people with a great blow. And the people of Beit Shemesh said, who can possibly stand before Hashem, this holy God, to whom among us can the ark ascend? They then sent emissaries to the inhabitants of Kiryat Yarim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of Hashem. Come down and bring it up to yourselves. What was God getting so angry about? What were these 50 and 75 people? Let's start with that issue. The number of people that were actually killed. Rashi explains Rabbeinu Amru, the rabbis have said, Shivim ish shekol echad o yoshoku k'chamishim elef. It either means 70 people were killed, but each one had the value of 50,000. These were the 70 most outstanding people of that part of the country. Or 50,000 ish, or it was 50,000 people who were killed, shekol echad shoku k'shivim sanhedrin. And each one of them was as much of a sage and a wise person as the entire 70 members of the Sanhedrin. So however we look at this, this was a major blow of quality. According to one view, it was quantity as well, 50,000 people. According to the other view, it was only 70 people. But either way, qualitatively, the figure is the same. It's 70 times 50,000. Which is what? 3.5 million, is that right?
Yeah. 3.5 million.
Three and a half million. Okay? In quality, therefore, half the Holocaust. If we want to think of it in that kind of scale, what the blow to Jewish learning, to Jewish knowledge, to Jewish civilization was 50% of the Holocaust. That's what occurred at that time. And there are a lot of things that we need to try and understand around this. The first is the measuring not by number of people only, but also by quality of people. And again, that's something that we're not all that comfortable with in the Western world today, where we like to give each person an equal kind of weighting to a large degree. But it isn't so. People don't have equal weightings. And there are very few political systems that give people equal weightings. It's just interesting how the different political systems make sure that people don't have equal weightings. So you've got, in England, you've got the system of the two houses of parliament and the House of Lords when it used to work properly. You've got the way elections work there, where the Prime Minister is in fact chosen by a small group of people, not by the nation. The cabinet officials are all chosen by a small elite group of people. It's true that that elite group of people are elected, but they're elected, there's not much choice that the people have in that election really at the end of the day. So although we look at democracies and we think that everybody has an equal say, they don't really have so. And it always troubled me about the United States. How does America handle that? Because here everybody does seem to have an equal say. But of course it didn't take me long to realize that it isn't so at all. That the lobbying process in the United States is a very important counterbalance to democracy. At the end of the day, the fact is there are business interests that do have a lot of money and therefore can wield influence far beyond the numbers of votes that they have. They can use their money to lobby. And it's proper that they can do so. They perhaps shouldn't be the only ones able to do so. There are other people maybe who don't have that kind of money who should also wield more influence than one lone voice. But whatever it is, the different democratic models that exist throughout the world try as far as possible to balance the sense of everybody having one voice, a single voice, with certain people and certain powers having more, with all the dangers that brings in, obviously, with it. As far as we're concerned in the Torah and Jewishly, we've never looked at people as equal in that sense. The Gemara often comments that somebody was worth or was equal to 10 of somebody else, or 2 of somebody else, or somebody plus somebody, always in this case 70 people each was worth 50,000, or 50,000 people each was worth 70 people. There is an understanding of the varying capacities of people, that different people have different capacities, and how you measure it, whether it's in terms of their piety or it's in terms of their ability to impact, in terms of their ability to make a contribution to the world around them. There's no way that you can say that an Einstein is equal to one human being. It isn't so. His impact on the lives of millions of people and millions of people for centuries to come is so enormous that you can't say he's equal to one man. He has one vote. It isn't really so. And so when we look at tragedy, it's also, as much as we value every human being, and we value him infinitely, and this is the paradox, that if every human being has infinite value, how can 10 human beings be more valuable than one? Or how can one great human being be more valuable than another? How can infinity be more than infinity? But it can be. There is infinity and there's infinity. Like there's equality and there's equality. So We all have infinite value, but some of us have more infinite value than others. That's really what it is. The infinite value is the lowest sense of value. Everybody starts with an infinite value. But within infinity, there is a quantitative progression that they can be. And there is such a thing as a particular human being or a particular group of human beings having a capacity to influence, and therefore a responsibility, which goes far beyond their responsibilities as single human beings. And that means that with all the privileges that come with that, and there are privileges with it, there's enormous responsibility. So imagine, for example, that there was a human being who could have dissuaded Hitler. Imagine if there was one person who could have gone to Hitler, and there's one person who Hitler would have listened to and would have said to him, "Hitler, stop this madness. Just go and retire. He has a whole packet of money, and leave the world alone. And certainly leave the Jews alone." Imagine there was such a person. And he said, when it came to it, "You know what? Not my business." And we say to him, "But what have you got to lose?" He says, "I've got nothing to lose. It's just not my business." Would it be fair to hold such a person responsible for what happened afterwards? Surely, to some degree. Holding him responsible doesn't mean you're saying that Hitler's not responsible. Two people can be responsible equally or something that happens. So just as when somebody is able to influence people and to swing people positively and doesn't do so, he bears the responsibility for that. So when he swings them positively, when he does swing them positively, he gets the credit for that. It works both ways. And that's why communication is so powerful, and that's why the responsibilities of communication are so powerful. The extent to which we impact on people is far beyond that which we ourselves recognize and understand. The chain effect sometimes of it, but even without the chain effect, even just the direct effect of a nice word, of putting something in a particular way, of formulating an idea in a particular way, of persuading a person to do something or not to do something, our ability to influence one another is far greater than we're willing to credit ourselves with. And that means to influence each other positively and to influence each other negatively. And one of the perhaps most comfortable and dangerous elements of the society in which we live today is the sense of, "I'll leave you alone as long as you leave me alone. I won't try and change your life, don't you try and change my life." In one sense, there is a great comfort in that freedom, and in another sense, there is a great abdication of communication responsibility, of the ability of people to enrich one another by engaging themselves in challenging debate and saying, "I will not lay off you. I think what you're doing is wrong. Now let's discuss it. Let's debate it." And if that were happening more, there would be more influencing, both positively and negatively, but people would be in positions to make choices more informedly than they are today, when there's a standoff sense, when people have taken the attitude far more of standing off and not engaging in that debate at all. And so when we find something going horribly wrong in a society, the people who could have made the difference and didn't carry the can. And that's really hard. Now, if we look at the Holocaust, there's no way we can try and understand and explain and rationalize the Holocaust yet. Perhaps someday in the future things will become a little bit clearer. The enormity of the tragedy, of the suffering, of the cruelty is far beyond anything we have the mental capacity to deal with in a satisfying way. We can simply try here and there to get some kind of glimpse of sensibility into it, but it's very difficult indeed. But the one thing that we've got to start realizing is we've got to stop talking about the 6 million Jews. It was much more than the 6 million Jews. It's like if a person has a heart attack, I don't know if the doctors can tell me, how much does a heart weigh? Okay, a couple of pounds. And to say, you know, the person lost a couple of pounds of flesh with his heart. That's what he lost. When we talk about, "Oh, you know what happened? 6 million Jews died." That's true. It's a terrible thing. 6 million Jews died. But much more important, look, which 6 million? Look what they left behind. They left us. The cream went. The great ones went. The heart of Jewish society went. The brains went. The brilliance went. The piety went. The sanctity went. They left us. The people who needed them. The people who were following them. The people who were desperate for them. Left us alone, abandoned. This is like a family that lost its parents. It's not a parent. It's a big family. 12, only two people died. Thank you. It's the two parents. Not the same. It's the very heart of the nation that died. And so the first thing we've got to do is understand when we're talking about tragedy, as we are over here, not just to measure it quantitatively. As big as the quantitative shock is in 6 million people, it's incredible. It's enormous. It's horrific as a proportion of the whole nation, what that was. It was more than half of the nation was wiped out at that time. Well, nearly half of the nation. But more than that, in terms of the quality of people, the quality of thinking, the scholarship of the people, the leadership of the people, it was the whole nation was wiped out. Everything was gone. Can we understand why God did it? No, we can't. Certainly not yet. But somehow there needs to be an understanding. Why does he take the heart? Why does he take the leadership? We see precedents for it. When things go horribly wrong, the people who pay the price are the leaders. It works in another way too, that sometimes God takes saints away, saintly people away, when things are so horrible he just doesn't want them to be part of it. There are situations where society has gone so rotten that he removes the saints, he removes the pious people from that society because the society doesn't deserve those people, and those people don't deserve to be part of that society. They deserve something better than that. So that happens sometimes too. But clearly there's a sense in the piece that we're studying that something horrific happened, and these people could have avoided it, and they didn't. Now, what was so horrific that justified wiping out 3.5 million people in quality? Only 70 or 50,000 in quantity, but 3.5 million people in quality. What did they do? Now, there are a couple of different views here, and here we need to look at the Hebrew. The first glimpse of what they did, we will find in verse 13 of this chapter. Uveit Shemesh Kotzrim Kitzir Chitim Boemek. And the city of Beit Shemesh, the town, the community of Beit Shemesh, was harvesting its harvest in the valley. Vayis'u etz einehem, and they lifted up their eyes. Vayir'u etz ha'aron, and they saw the ark. Vayismuchu liros, and they had joy in seeing. And then what did they do? We're not told. What do you think they did? Imagine the picture. There they are, busy harvesting the field. They lifted up their eyes. They saw the ark. They said, ah, the ark, great. And then? Went back to work. That's what they did. Now, that sounds callous. It sounds, could that really have been for 7 months? The ark had been in captivity. And they see this ark coming their way. All of a sudden, miraculously, these cows are leading the ark. Did they really just go back to work? Did they not take off time and fix the ark up and make a place for it? Did they just go back to work? You know where you'll begin to understand it is you can be sitting at a simcha, be sitting at a wedding. Not can be. It's a personal experience that I've had, and I'm sure many, if not all of you, have had too. And around the table, there will be people who are telling me that they're learning the Daf Yomi. They're learning a page a day of Talmud. And around the table, there might even be a discussion about some of the contents, because if they're learning the Daf Yomi, they're all learning the same page. They're all at the same place. And sometimes there's some quite interesting discussion, debate around the table. A rabbi will get up to speak. What are they doing? They're either keeping talking. So that is bad enough. Or they're eating, which is even worse, which is standard practice, if you'll notice. Look around. People are talking at a simcha, everybody else is eating. Or even worse, they're at the buffet table. And even at the buffet table, we had a simcha in our community yesterday. While the host was talking, there were people at the buffet table. The man who's invited you is talking, and you're at the buffet table stuffing your mouth. And what is the talk? The rabbi is getting up and talking, or the host, what's the talk after all? It's Torah. The very Torah you've just said a few minutes before, I'm learning the Daf Yomi. Every day I learn a page of Talmud. The rabbi gets up to discuss, to talk Torah, and now we'll see it in action. What do you do when you've got a plate of food and you've got Torah? Which do you choose? Let's see the value of the Daf Yomi. You choose the food. Carry on eating. That's what you think of the Torah. That's what it's worth to you. That's the true test. Not you, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about people. Those people one sees doing that. Carry on eating where somebody's getting up to talk. Even if he wasn't talking Torah, even if he was talking about the weather, it's rude. Even if we weren't Jewish, it would be rude. If we weren't Jewish, it would be rude. Not even. Wouldn't be accepted practice. But at Jewish simchas, it's okay. Even if it's the host, certainly. Even if it's not the host, if it's an ordinary person, show him the courtesy. Sit and listen to the man. He's talking. After all, you're a guest. You don't own the place. You're a guest. And at least the person who's talking, even if he isn't the host, has been invited by the host to talk. But when it's a rabbi, and the rabbi is talking, and people are milling around and mulling around, and children running in and children running out, and there are people standing up and people sitting down and people eating, and the waiter's food, that's not Torah. I refuse to speak in those situations. I will not subject the Torah to that kind of disgrace. And what they did was no different. The Torah comes. Of course they revered the Torah. They looked up, yay, the Torah's coming. Baruch Hashem, they must have said. Gets back to work, guys. Work carried on. At the end of the day, that was more important. That's where the value system is tested. Rashi learns it a little differently. Those of you who've got it can look inside, and otherwise I'll read it to you. Rashi says something quite amazing. And he says the following. Vayismechu lirot. If you look at the words in your Tanakh, I just want to check if it works in the way they've translated it in English. Okay, your English translates it in verse 13. The people of Beit Shemesh were reaping the wheat harvest in the valley when they raised their eyes and saw the ark, and they rejoiced to see it. That's the way it is in the English. The Hebrew more accurately is Vayismachu lirot, Vayismachu lirois, they enjoyed seeing it. Okay, do you see the difference? Not they saw it and rejoiced, they enjoyed seeing it. Rashi says the following. Hayu mistaklin heichu bo levado. They were looking, look how it's coming on its own. Magic. Amazing. Umisim chatam nagu boi kolus rosh. And in their rejoicing, they treated it with a degree of disrespect. Shelo ayu mistaklim bo ba'em over derech kovod. They didn't look at it with reverence. Now there are three things in this Rashi that we have to understand. First thing is, they looked at the miracle. The second thing is, out from the rejoicing they came to lightheadedness. The third thing is, they didn't look at it with reverence. I want to analyze each of those because each of them are magnificent concepts. The first, they looked at the magic. What should they have rejoiced in? What is really the cause of the rejoicing? The Torah is coming back. What do we mean by the Torah is coming back? Do we mean some stones in a box on the back of a wagon being drawn by two cows? Is that what we mean by the Torah? The Torah coming back should be the values of the Torah are coming back. The wisdom of the Torah is coming back. The ability to access the Torah is coming back. They were caught up in the magic, in the sorcery. And we've got that today. Haven't we got that today where people will go to rabbis nowadays? It's the in thing to go to these visiting rabbis for blessings. And that's how they even pay money, I understand. It's quite a business. It's a thriving business to go and get a blessing from these visiting guys that come and dish them out for various sums of money. And sometimes they'll give little charms and little formulas and little things to say and little things to do. That's not our way. The Torah supplies us with the wisdom we need to make a success of any issue we're facing. Sometimes we know how to access that wisdom, Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we access the wisdom correctly, but we don't have the strength of character or the circumstance to implement it correctly. And we blow it. But what the Torah is providing us is a magnificent source of intellect, of reasoning, of thinking, and of wisdom. To get caught up in the magic of the Torah, that's very sad. And very often you'll hear people talking, and what will they talk about? You hear so-and-so did such a miracle, and it was such a miracle, and this person couldn't have a child, and he went to Rabbi so-and-so, and he said, gobbledygook, and then they had a child, and it's fantastic, and it's wonderful. That's not Judaism. That's not the Torah. The Torah is some kind of logical understanding, some kind of opening up of the mind. To look at the image of the Torah coming back from 7 months in the Philistines, that's a whole revolution that should be taking place in their minds. Not the celebration of the magic. Look at the cows. They're walking by themselves. Miracle! As Jews, we don't get excited by miracles. Miracles are not exciting. We believe fully that the prophets of other nations are capable of doing miracles. We believe fully that magicians, that people with mystical powers can perform miracles even if there's no sanctity. We believe fully that there's a force of evil that can perform miracles. Miracles is just nature in a different form. The miracle is not the thing to get excited about. The thing to get excited about is the wisdom, the brilliance, the depths, the beauty, the sanctity. That's what they used to get excited about. And they got excited, says Rashi, "Hayu mistaklim heichu bo levado." They were looking at how it was traveling by itself. Miracle. And that led to the next thing. And from their rejoicing, they came to Kalut Rosh. Very interesting. Joy is an important part of the Torah. To have fun. But that isn't so. There's a concept of Ivdu is Hashem b'simcha, of serving God rejoicely and with joy. And the theme of simcha, of joy, comes over and over and over again. And look how many joyful days we have in the Torah and how many sorrowful days we have in the Torah. Even Yom Kippur is not a sorrowful day. Even Yom Kippur is a joyful day. Yom Kippur itself is a day of Yom Tov. It's a day of simcha. Tisha B'Av, we have one day in the calendar. Only one day. And it's a temporary day. It's not going to be there forever. And yes, we have the few weeks of mourning, but in terms of a day where there are laws that govern and there are negative laws in terms of not having fun and pleasure, one day in the year. We have a Shabbos, and Shabbos is meant to be joyous. And yet there is a hairline's difference between rejoicing and being light. And being light isn't a Jewish concept. And there is a difference between having fun and being light. Joy and celebration and being light. To be light means that I can only rejoice by escaping reality. And the essence of my joy and my fun is that I'm in another world. Joy is that I find joy and celebration in reality. And they sound very far from one another, but they're not. For example, the joy and the pleasure, the fun that comes through drinking is generally lightheadedness, it's not joy. On the other hand, we usher in Shabbos with a drink. So the Torah fully acknowledges that we sometimes need to use a little bit of help in getting ourselves out of the heaviness of the weightiness of day-to-day activity and into another world. But we're supposed to then get beyond that and get into a point where we're now linking into the sanctity of Shabbos, which feeds our joy. It's not an escape from the 6 days. That's not what Shabbos is. Shabbos is not, let's pretend there is no 6 days. Let's pretend we don't have to worry about that awful world out there. No, not at all. Shabbos is full knowledge of the world out there. It's just an uplifting ourselves into a place where we can plug into the Shabbos experience, which can feed that joy. And during the 6 days, there are other things that can feed our joy, and they have to feed our joy. But we've got to feed our joy through real things, not through illusions. We've got to feed our joy through real things and not through the escape from real things, through pretending that things aren't happening. We've got to feed that joy through relationships. We've got to feed that joy through intimacy. We've got to feed that joy through the things we do, the impact that we make, the ideas that we grapple with, the discussions that we have, the contributions that we make to one another, the chesed that we do, the exciting experiences that we have, the beautiful experiences that we're able to see, whether it's the sunset or the flower or somebody's beautiful action or a piece of poetry or a piece of music or whatever it is. Real things that give us joy. Lightheadedness is when So let's just forget about the world for a while and just let's have fun. That's not joy. To find one's fun out of an escape from the world is not joy, that's lightheadedness. Now they came to lightheadedness. Umisimchasam, and as a result of their simcha, of their joy, Naaguboy Kalud Rosh, they dealt with the ark with a degree of Kalud Rosh, of lightheadedness. And where did that originate from? That originated from their intrigue with the magic rather than their intrigue with the content. When you get caught up in the magic rather than in the essence, you run the risk of turning celebration and rejoicing into lightheadedness. And that's what they did. And the next thing is the third statement of Rashi, which is perhaps the most fascinating thing of all. Shelo hayu mistaklim bo be'emo v'derech kovod. There's a way to look that is derech kovod. Kovod means with dignity, with honor. Now we know you can speak to somebody with dignity and honor, and you can speak to somebody with indignity and with dishonor. We know that you can treat somebody with dignity and with honor, and you can treat somebody with indignity and with dishonor. But that there's a way to look that is dignified and is honorable. Not so much in the impact it has on the object, but in the impact the object has on you. So if you, for example, were to go to the Louvre in Paris, and imagine that the Mona Lisa would not be placed in a special place with a rope around it and a special carpet in front of it and hundreds of people milling around it looking at it. Imagine it would be placed in the restrooms. The same Mona Lisa, no different, painted by the same Leonardo da Vinci. Would you notice it? Would you look at it twice? The way you look at something also determines your relationship with it. You can decide if you want something to be a source of honor for you, or you want something to be cheap. The value that an object or a fellow human being has in your relationship to him can be determined not only by the way you act towards that human being, but, says Rashi, even mistaklim, the way you look at that human being. You can make a decision. I'm going to look at him as if he is worthy. I'm going to look at it as if it is something of great honor and great value. And let me see what I find. When you look at something assuming it is valuable, you find some very amazing things about it. When you look at something assuming it's cheap, you don't find anything. So if the Mona Lisa was in the restrooms, you wouldn't notice anything. And perhaps even some of the great art critics wouldn't notice all that much. But when it's standing over there, you say, there must be something to it. Let me look, let me figure, let me study, let me ask, let me read. Let me go into it a little bit. You determine by the way you look how much value you want to attach to it. And we need to understand that in our relationships with one another. We determine the honorability that others, to some degree, of course the other person also has to be an honorable person. But we have the capacity within ourselves, by the way we look at the world, to determine how much value we will find in the world. If you start with the premise that you're dealing with something valuable, treat it as valuable and you will find value in it. Or you may well find value in it. If you don't find value in it, discard it then. But if you start off looking at it cheaply, you will find only cheapness in it. Even if what you're looking at is the Torah itself. That's the brilliant outcome of this piece of Rashi. That you might say, well, that applies to the Mona Lisa, but if you're looking at the Torah, surely the Torah is objectively glorious, the Torah is objectively dignified, the Torah is objectively valuable. No, nothing's objectively valuable. The most objectively valuable object can be as cheap as anything if it's viewed cheaply by people. And if we want to take a cheap attitude, believe me, when people are milling around, when Torah is being taught, when Torah is being discussed and people are milling around and eating and helping themselves at buffet, Torah is cheap. It is worthless. It has no value. It makes no difference that people are studying it and learning it and observing it. It has no value. It's being treated with cheapness. It's viewed cheaply, and it is cheap. It's only when one views something with honor and with dignity. I'm sure this country wasn't that different to many other countries, and it wasn't that long ago when students used to go into lectures at university and had to have jackets and ties on. Now that must have been uncomfortable. But their studies must have been different. To actually get dressed for a lecture, to actually get dressed to go and meet your professor, to realize that you're going to something of value and of worth that needs that kind of preparation, that's looking at it with honor and with dignity. And that's our idea of getting dressed for Shabbos, of getting dressed for shul, of dressing our children for shul, of dressing for Friday night dinner, even if we're just having it at home and even if there are no guests. Create an aura of value if you want people to find value in it. Because even the most valuable thing in the world, if there isn't an aura of value, will not attract value and will not have value. If diamonds were treated like little bits of glass, they would be as valuable as little bits of glass. It's because people treat them valuably that they are valuable. And lastly, there is the view of the Targum, of the Aramaic translation. If you look very briefly in verse 19, it's translated very well in the English here to include that understanding. And he smote some of the men of Beit Shemesh because they peered disrespectfully into the Ark of Hashem. It says literally in the Hebrew, let me translate it accurately for you, and he smote among the men of Beit Shemesh, for they looked into the Ark of Hashem. And the Targum in the Aramaic translation translated in the following way and says, the people were smitten because they rejoiced while looking at the Ark of God while it was uncovered. Now what's the terrible thing? What's inside the Ark of God is the Torah. Inside the Ark of God are the tablets of stone. What's the terrible thing of rejoicing while you're looking at it uncovered? In the act of devaluing, there's a very easy way to devalue. You start off with very commonly used words. It is nothing but, or it is nothing more than. And the act of devaluing is a very important tool of business. Anybody who buys in business, whether he's buying services or he's buying goods, knows that the way he's going to get a better price is by devaluing the goods, by devaluing the service. And the way to do it, they teach you in negotiation, is break it down into its component parts. Because then the person actually finds it very difficult to justify. So you say, right, what raw materials are you actually using and how much is it worth? How much time are you putting into it? Add a couple of percentage, a little bit, you need to make a bit of a margin on it as well, but that's still 10% of what you quoted me. Now what's going on here? And that's exactly the same as if one would go to the Getty Museum and look at the $50 million Van Gogh and say, okay, how much paint? How many grams of paint? How much is the canvas, the framing, and how many hours did Van Gogh work? At what rate? Let's pay him. At whose rate should we pay him? The top consultant in the world? Should we pay him $50,000 an hour? You're not going to get to $50 million. Break it down into its component parts, and you can devalue anything. A human being is nothing but a bit of DNA. At the end of it all, what's a couple of molecules? We're nothing. We can break even the human being, you can break down to absolutely nothing if you break something down into its component parts. You can break an idea into its component parts. Now of course this is very, very difficult and delicate, because in order to understand something and grasp something, you sometimes do need to break it down into its component parts. But that's to grasp how it operates, not what its value is. You will not find the value of anything in its component parts. You'll find the value of everything in the way those component parts are put together. That's the brilliance. There's no brilliance in the parts themselves. And work out the paint on the Van Gogh irises. Nothing brilliant about the paint he used. It's the way he put them together. Every little dot, every little stroke, that's the brilliance. Go and put a price on that. That's something that we have to understand, that even the Torah can be demolished by breaking it down into things that become insignificant. So somebody can say to you, why are you a religious Jew? Why are you Jewish? Why do you keep the Torah? Well, it's God, it's the Torah, and Mount Sinai, and a wonderful system. All very nice, because you're talking about the whole thing. So he starts by, okay, let's talk Shabbos. Oh, Shabbos, a wonderful thing. Shabbos, the family stays at home together. We don't go everywhere. Anybody's at home, we go to shul, we come back. Wonderful Shabbos. Come and join us for a Shabbos and you'll see. Person comes and says, yes, indeed. Shabbos is back. Let's break it down a little bit more. I understand Shabbos, but you know, this business of not turning the lights on. Come on. Well, you start working out why not turning the lights on. You can break it down to the point where it becomes absurd. And you can break anything down to the point where it becomes absurd. We've got to understand that the process of understanding requires sometimes taking things apart. But the process of valuing requires tying things together. And if somebody wants to understand why you can't switch the light on Shabbos, he's got to be willing to discuss the relationship of that law to every other component part, not only of Shabbos, but of the entire Torah. Only there can one begin to see the value of what it's all about. I'm going to stop. This is a hint. Thanks. As we break into the component parts in our attempt to understand, we lose the sense of value. And there's very much of an essence. And we get ourselves on the defensive. In business it happens all the time. If you allow yourself to be taken down that route as a supplier, you're dead already. If you allow the process, it's none of your business, Mr. Buyer, to question me on the components of what I'm offering you. I'm offering you something that has been ingeniously put together. Decide whether you want it or not. That's all. That's your choice. This is it. This is its price. And your decision is whether you want it or not. Not how long it took me to make it. If I made it in a flash of genius in the middle of the night and it took me 1 second, that's got nothing to do with its value to you. Its value to you has to be determined in terms of what it is to you, not how long it took me to make it. And so it is with our value systems, and so it is with Yiddishkeit. If you want to discuss the value, why we do things and what they're worth, don't allow yourself to take yourself or to be taken down the path of total fragmentation. If you want to understand value, discuss relationships. Discuss the interaction, the linkages between all the different things we believe and how they interface not only with the Torah but with life. Then you can start talking about the value of Torah. You want to know how it works? Then you can analyze the minute detail of how each component works. But that deals with the engineering of Torah, not with the brilliance and beauty of its philosophy and its meaning. And so these people are criticized for opening the ark and looking, and what did they see inside? Go there, go to the ark, open it up. All this excitement, and the ark's coming back after 7 months. And you open it up, what do you see inside? Some stone. That's all. Some stone, some engraved stone. Is that what all the excitement is about? Keep the mystery rather. Don't look at the stone. Look at the concept. Understand what's there. That's what's really important. Understanding what the meaning of it is. Understanding what the essence of it is. That's what we get excited about. And that's what we value. And the fact, whichever interpretation we take, and they're probably all equally accurate, that they didn't stop their business while they were doing it, that their rejoicing became lightheaded and became entertainment instead of enjoyment, or the third view, that they peered inside in a disgraceful way and they saw, after all, what is it? It's nothing but some stones, these stupid Philistines getting all excited about these stones that they returned to us. Whichever route we take, this was an outcome of poor education. This was a community that had not been led to understand the true value of Torah and how to elevate it. And therefore the punishment went to the leaders of the community, unfortunately, not to the community itself. It went to the cream of a community to teach clearly that the problem here was not in the way the people reacted. The problem was here in the way the people were taught to value the Torah, or rather the way the people were not taught to value the Torah. And these lessons, as ancient as they are worryingly appropriate and relevant for our day too. Where we see, when we begin to understand, to analyze, when you read the story of Philistines and Israel and arks and idols that look like mermaids and they fall, you look at it and you think, what archaic, cute stuff this is. But when you understand what the issues really were, it becomes embarrassingly relevant when we look at our own day and say, my goodness, have we come any further? And if this is the kind of thing God gets angry about, what are we doing about it? How are we making sure that we address value, that we address the elevation of the Torah into what it truly is, not the breaking it down into things that it isn't? Thank you.